everything that most of us do in life, we are literally walking through the ideas of someone else. The clothes that you put on, the office that you walk to, the train, the infrastructure, everything is an idea that someone had created. That's a vision of their own. We are living through the eyes of someone else. It's only when you start to say, okay, I'm going to create my own reality, do things either get better? Do you have some level of control? And that's ultimately what I set out to do.
What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have George Crishlow here. He's an entrepreneur, a founder and CEO of a company called Kinsho, and a freelance strategy director. He's worked in places like Wolf Olins and Red Scout. And today we're going to talk a little bit about that strategy and freelance strategy life, but especially about what it's like to create a company, and specifically a company that creates outerwear, as in clothing. Welcome, George.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I want to get into this journey. I feel like there are a lot of great brains in the strategy world. It does attract really interesting thinkers, but a lot of those thinkers prefer to think and don't always back themselves in launching their own companies. Not that they have to, but many of them have an inkling that it's something they would like to do. Your company, Kinsho, K-Y-N-S-H-O, it's nearly 3 years in the existence. It's won a bunch of awards, Retailer United second place winner in 2020, Facebook grant recipient, Startup Leadership Program class of 2020, mixture of awards and support in various forms. What got you into the place from thinking, you know what, I don't mind doing this strategy work, but I'd really like to launch my own company and my own product?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I actually got into strategy because I started a company. So 15, 20 years ago, I actually had a company in high school that got me to college. And I started another business in college, which got me into marketing and advertising. So I've always actually been an entrepreneur. And I've let my entrepreneur jury guide me into branding, marketing, digital. So when I first started my journey, I started off at AKQA as employee, number 10 in New York when they first opened. And I didn't have a job title. I didn't have a role. They just liked the way that I thought, because I did things. I made things. And it was more of, I was culturally tapped in. I was aware. I was observant. And I knew how to take action. And, you know, one day Lars, who ran it, he was like, hey, you are a strategy person. That's what you do now. And then I just went down the rabbit hole of learning and digging into what strategy was. But I always acted as an entrepreneur. We didn't have a department, nothing. I just kind of said, oh, that's what's needed. That's what I observe from the things that I like to make. How do I do that in the service of brands? So that's kind of how I got into strategy.
What was the high school company?
It was oddly enough, it was another lifestyle brand. It was called 50/50. I made bamboo hats for people in the summertime. So what I realized in New York City, and I wear a lot of hats, you can't see me now, but I usually have a hat on. And in the summertime, I would sweat out my traditional baseball hats because they were made out of cotton. But I observed in Chinatown and in the Bronx, African communities, they would wear bamboo hats. And I was like, why are they wearing bamboo hats? Come to discover, after talking to a bunch of people, bamboo wickers, it dissipates sweat. It's also a malleable, pliable material. So what I did is I made a baseball hat out of bamboo, which then, you know, I took it to a bunch of clients. I'm from Brooklyn. Then I grew up in Queens. So I did kind of the FUBU route. I went to the Coliseum, sold it on the street. And then I started doing fashion shows, and I got Beyonce, Maxwell, and Madonna as clients. And that's what actually got me to college.
How old are you at this time?
16.
Oh, I love it. I love it. When you say you were making bamboo hats, were you physically making them, or were you designing them and then having them made?
No. So what I did, the process was, I would go to Canal Street, where people all sell the fake stuff. And I would sit with, you know, an old Chinese lady or a person from Ghana. And I'd say, this is what I want to do. And then they would literally sit and mold it. And then I would go up to the Bronx and learn how to do it. And then I would sketch out what my design was. And then I would find other people who knew how to make it. So in Queens, the Coliseum, this place where you go get Prince made and things like that. And then I would make them And then I would set up like a little thing on the street and I would sell them. And then other people would notice me. And then I would go to like fashion weeks, nightclubs. Like I would stay out all night at clubs and I would wear my stuff all the time. And that's how I started to get clients and a little bit of buzz. And then, you know, people say, hey, you got something good here. You know, I want to help you out. And, you know, magazines, articles, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. How many of them were you making at a time? Was it one by one or were you doing?
No. Batches? So I actually had a staff of five people. And I actually found people in Thailand to make them for me. And then they would ship it to me in the wintertime and I would sell it here in the summer. And then I would resell them in their wintertime. So it was a bi-seasonal product that I could sell all year round.
Hmm. Ooh, I take it you're no longer selling bamboo hats? Like, why did you stop?
Well, I stopped selling it because I went to college and I got caught up in going to college because I come from an immigrant family. No one has above a fifth grade education in my family. And they're like, you should go to college. And I wasn't a good student. I actually couldn't read for a long time. But because I knew how to make money, I was actually, you know, I probably made $250,000, you know, in my senior year of college without any experience. And like, that kind of got me into, I went to Georgetown because I wanted to understand international business because I was dealing on an international level with, you know, a lot of, you know, for a 16-year-old, you know, that was a lot of money. And so I had employees and I was responsible for people. And after I started taking like business school classes, I got kind of disillusioned and I said, I don't want to be responsible for people. I want to go have fun. I want to dick around. I want to, you know, be a young person. And that's kind of why I started it, because I really just liked observing people. I liked selling the idea. I liked finding people's pain points and I liked making things that solved their needs. And that's what I cared about. And I said, what can I do that will allow me to do that to the best of my ability? That's still fun. And that's what got me into marketing advertising.
All right. Did you say $250,000 in your senior year of high school or of college?
High school.
It was of your high school. Okay. I think high school. I heard college. That's a high lot school. Of money for that age.
It is. But I was, so that's the reason why I made that much money is because, like I said, I couldn't read for a very long time. I was a bad student. And my father told me, he said, if you do not go to college, I'm going to kick you out of the house. And he was very serious. So I had no option because I didn't have good grades. I couldn't go to any local school. And I'm a very independent person. I didn't want to have someone either be responsible for me or I couldn't make my way. So I got very motivated at that point in time. And because of that, that got me, you know, by hook or crook into, you know, I think, you know, I got accepted to like three Ivy League schools. I wasn't going to go to one. But because I knew how to make money and I knew how to sell an idea, I knew how to sell myself, people took a chance on me.
Right. So, I mean, $250,000 is a lot to anybody, let alone somebody in high school. What did you do with that money? Did it just sit somewhere or were you spending it?
No, that paid for college.
Okay. Okay. And what was your reading level like at that time before you entered college?
I mean, it was basic. I'm slightly dyslexic. So, you know, I could read, I can process things, but it, you know, I would stumble, but it more made me observant. Like that's where I learned to observe people's unspoken behavior. And that's how I was like, okay, there's an opportunity here because I have this problem. I see other people with the same problem. If I can't speak well, I have to make something to express myself. And that was the outcome.
Right. So for those listeners who are trying to keep up, you earned enough money to pay to go to college. And that college was Georgetown. And I'm no college expert, but that's a very good and expensive college, right?
Correct. Some would
and
say.
And you did all of that in high school.
That's what got me to college, yes.
Whoa. Do you feel like you peaked too early?
I do. I didn't know what I didn't know. And that's what was my strength because I was figuring things out as I went by. There was no rules. There was no one to say, you shouldn't do it that way. I was making up my own rules. And then when I went to college, there were rules. There were ways to do things. And I got frustrated. I didn't do well in school at all either in college. What I did in college was I ran the school newspaper. From the marketing side, I went there specifically because it was the only organization on the school campus that made money. So, you know, we have something called the Hoya, which is a school newspaper. But they had an annual budget of like $2-3 million. And I got that up to about $5 million by the time I was done with it. So I spent all my time doing that, like figuring out, oh, how do I get local business to advertise? How do I get this newspaper online? How do I get people to run ads in our school newspaper? And I knew I was doing a good job because, you know, Georgetown is a Jesuit university. When I got a call from the Vatican and they said, you can't run ads, certain types of ads in the newspaper because that's not what we're about. So I knew people were paying attention to me. So that's when I knew I had kind of an important role in school. So I wanted to manage the money.
All right. And earlier you said that you set up or ran a business in college. Is this what you're talking about? Or did you actually set up your own business as well then?
So in college, I stopped running the business. I let one of my partners, I just sold my shares to him. And I said, I just want to be a college student. So he took it and eventually, you know, it died a horrible death because I'm the one with the big ideas. He was more of a tactical execution type person. So I was like, all right, well, that's done. So what's next?
And what was next?
So I went into marketing and advertising.
Got it. Okay, so you didn't start another business in college. You spent most of your time when you weren't not studying, you spent it with the newspaper, the college newspaper.
Newspaper and hanging out with other kids who had businesses. So my roommate, I had a suite of classmates, people that I found, and I didn't connect with a lot of people, who were also entrepreneurs. So we kind of had like a little enclave of three apartments and we all had businesses and we were all run our businesses out of our dorm rooms in some form or fashion. So like that was the best thing about the college experience that I remembered. And I never wanted to let go of that. I always wanted that. So I long story short, I always knew I was going to be an entrepreneur, but I didn't know in what capacity for the long term. But my personality is built where I have an independent streak and I need to make manifest things in a way that's unique to me. And college taught me that because I don't know if you know about schools like Georgetown, but they're very vanilla and they teach you, they structure and teach you how to not think. They teach you how to fit in. So they try to stare you down a path of this is the way you should go. You need to experience blah, blah, blah. And I fell into that trap a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. The thought of not fitting in is actually pretty common with entrepreneurs from things that I've read. And the one way to, I guess, to look at that is the word independence. But that independence isn't just, I want to feel free. It's, I want to feel free. And you know what? I don't fit into what exists. So that's often quite common. And then the need to create, the need to manifest is also there. What else do you like about entrepreneurship?
Well, the thing I like about it is, and it's deeply personal. It's an expression of who I am. Mm-hmm. And it's about creating a new and better reality in the way I see it. So, you know, if I fast forward a little bit and I went into, you know, corporate world, corporate life, again, I didn't fit in. And I very much was uncomfortable in quote unquote corporate America because the cultures of companies that I was working at was not designed for me. I was constantly giving up a part of myself. Like I would go and I was not being myself. And it was clear. You know, I'd leave at the end of the day and I was like, I can take a breath. I can be myself. And what I realized, and I think about this every day, is everything that most of us do in life, we are literally walking through the ideas of someone else. The clothes that you put on, the office that you walk to, the train, the infrastructure, everything is an idea that someone had created that's a vision of their own. And we are living through the vision of the eyes of someone else. It's only when you start to say, okay, I'm going to create my own reality, do things either get better? Do you have some level of control? And that's ultimately what I set out to do in all the things that I did. So even the jobs that I took, you know, at Wolf Owens, AKQA, Red Scout, they were bringing me in to be myself in some form or fashion because I was doing things that other people didn't do. And that's what was attractive to them. And that's what was attractive to me and the outcomes that I was delivering.
That epiphany that you're potentially living someone else's reality or you're creating a reality, which is, you know, a binary, which might or might not be true. But that epiphany is also pretty common for artists and entrepreneurs. Is it something that you knew in yourself for a long time? Did you ever deny it in yourself? Do you hold it in a really powerful way now? And at times, maybe you didn't, you let go of it and realized that you just were hurting yourself?
Yeah. So every corporate job that I ever took was a compromise in that sense. Like I hopped around a lot, you know, in strategy and very intentionally, because I knew that by going to certain places that I wanted to learn certain skills, and I was going to give up a little bit of myself to understand and learn how to do the things that I wanted to do eventually. So, you know, I'll just give a quick summary. So I started at AKQA because I very much wanted to do digital technology. I wanted to invent new technologies. And when I went there, a lot of the things, the work that I did, we literally invented either new digital experiences, new technologies, and we did that for clients. And I quickly realized that, you know, I didn't want to work for companies who were asking me to create unique digital experiences to drive more traffic or create more sales for them. I said, in the example, epiphany that I think back to when I was at AKQA, we had Coca-Cola as a client, and I helped win that account for AKQA when they were just a baby. And it was literally seven of us. And I was a strategy guy without knowing I was doing strategy. But I said, I don't think Coca-Cola should be selling sugary water. What they should be doing is they should be making things that people want. And I knew right away at that moment, that's not what the job was. And that's when I switched to Wolf Owens. That's when I started looking at it. I said, I want to work on the brand innovation side. I want to be able to create new products and services that are brand-led, that come from a place that the world needs, and that's true to brands. And that's why I went to Wolf Owens. And a lot of the work that I did at Wolf Owens was about literally developing new brands, products, or services based on the cultures of those companies. And then I moved on to Red Scout after that for a different reason.
Which was?
So I was much more in a maker at that point. So, you know, at Wolf Owens, you know, I worked on a lot of things from a brand side, which was about, you know, again, creating ideas, understanding the world at large, and then figuring out what was best for that company to make. So I made stuff like Starbucks Double Shot. I made a product. I was part of the core team that made Target Up and Up. I was part of the core team that made something called Microsoft Courier. It's one of the best jobs I ever had, that I've ever worked on, that never saw the light of day. And that taught me a lot about the design process. And essentially what Microsoft Courier was, it was the surface before the surface. If you think of a digital moleskin with a leather-bounded book that had two digital screens, it was designed for the creative class, people who were more creative in terms of their outputs. And it was amazing. From a brand perspective, like, I informed a completely new UX and design, specifically designed for the way people, creative class people worked, lived and worked. And the reason why it failed is because on the business side, it used a new form of Windows. So there's something called a gated process that Microsoft uses, and it's about 7 to 8 different gates that it has to go through the chain all the way before it goes to market. And it failed the last one because it didn't run traditional Windows. And that was a big lesson for me, because what it taught me is that if it doesn't make business sense for the company, it doesn't make sense, because it has to be true to the culture of that company. And that's when I switched to Red Scout, where there was no brief. There was no, oh, it has to be aligned with our business. It was, what should we do next? It was just open questions. I had the permission to create whatever made strategic sense for the world at large and the problem, keeping in mind what made sense for the business. And that's what Red Scout allowed me to do. But at the same time, it taught me that if you want to get things to market, you have to understand how to scale an idea and all the different gates it needs to go through, which means you have to become a partner with not only the designers, but the business people. And so in between of that, I went to design school to learn how to design. I wasn't a designer at all. I didn't know anything about design. I knew how to inform design, but I never made anything myself besides, you know, my hat company, but I didn't make it still. So I literally had to go learn how to use my hands and how to take intangible ideas, not in the form of a deck, make tangible things, even from a design research standpoint, design thinking, all that stuff, but tangible things people could react to, question, and iterate and prototype to make that real. And that's when I went to Red Scout, that's what they were hiring me for, because I actually knew how to make things. Whereas in most people, and I'll say this generally, most people in strategy, even at the highest level, they don't know how to make things. They have to rely on a design partner to do it. And if you can't translate an idea to a designer, it's never going to come to market the way it's strategically intended to. So what made me, I would say, slightly different is I was honing along the way, how do I express my ideas in a way that it will go to market, that I can have a conversation with whoever's next within that process to make sure that the idea that I'm seeing that needs to be manifested in the world goes to market as the way I intend it to. And, you know, and eventually that ended up in me just starting my own company.
Hmm. I love it. I know that sometimes when we go through our autobiography, our history, we can make it sound cleaner and neater than it probably was in the moment. But that journey is a journey that I think a lot of people would benefit from understanding and from hearing you discuss, because there are a lot of people who want to get closer to the product, but they might start in an agency that's really about telling people about a product or about a brand, as in an advertising agency or a digital advertising agency. And often in those agencies, there's this idealism, which I love, but it can also be distracting, that, you know what, our strategy should really affect the product. And everyone's like, yeah. And the clients are like, nope, that's not going to happen. But you could spend a year or two thinking you're going to get closer to the product, and possibly you don't. So you've gone from an agency that tells people about the brand and the product to an agency that was creating the brand to an agency that was helping a client create a product to then making your own product. Do you think that you would skip any of those steps if you relived it?
No, I actually couldn't. I actually had to go through each one of those to get to where I am, because each one of those taught me a different lesson on how to get things to market. So I'm grateful for all of those experiences, but I was very intentional about where I wanted to go at each step. Okay. So once I knew what was missing at the previous one, I looked for companies that allow me to do the next thing myself. So as you say, like, people get frustrated with it. They don't know what's next. So I think some people, you know, say, there's no other option. But for me, it was, all right, well, I'm going to go find that other option. I'm going to look around and I'm going to see what's going to help me get to the next step of where I want to go. So
you were a good employee?
Probably not. Depending on where I was, I was good in spurts. Like I said, we were chatting earlier, I'm only good when I care about the things that I'm doing. So in each one of those instances, when I'm fully engaged in creating a new reality for whatever it is, it could be a message, it could be a new experience, it could be a new product or service, I'm fully engaged. But if I'm not working towards that big picture end goal, then I can kind of, you know, I let it be known very quickly.
Yeah, that's funny. That's one of those traits that I'm good when I care, that people could talk down about. Like, well, that's, you know, you got to try to find a way to care all the time, which could be true. Or you try to create a thing that you're going to care about all the time. So there are different ways to look at it. It's not that one's necessarily right or wrong. It's just that if you find in yourself that you really care when you care about something, but you don't care about it a lot, the implication could be create a thing that you're always going to care about, that's going to sustain you, that you can keep going with. And that is, again, a vibe or something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs would identify with. Tell us a bit about Kinsho. What is it and why did you create it?
So, you know, as you say that, part of my process about the time of when I didn't care about things, I got frustrated because when I was working at these companies, I was basically creating stories. I had to become a good storyteller. I had to show rationale about why an idea is good, and a lot of contemplative, you know, theory and stuff, things intangible. So what I did in my off time, I would take every dollar that I made and I would take maker classes. So, you know, I would take woodworking classes, I would take electronic classes, I would take sewing classes, I would take molding classes, anything that was physically tangible, that I can have a start and an end and an outcome, and people can look at it and say, you made that? Oh, that's good or bad. And that's what the end towards at when I was at Red Scout, that's what I was doing. And that culminated in me building a motorcycle because I no longer wanted to take the train, because I realized that my time was more valuable because I was working with, you know, CEOs and things like that. And I needed to look presentable and, you know, always be on point. But then I needed to go right in the same vein, right into a garage, get dirty, and then hop right back into a client meeting if need be. And what I realized through that process is that I was transitioning very frequently between one context to another. And a lot of the things that I needed to carry to be successful professionally, laptops, whatever else, research, didn't translate to what I needed to be successful as I was creating things. And that led me to the realization that a lot of the things that I wear and carry aren't designed for the way I live and work. And that was true for freelancers, a lot of freelancers. And that's eventually what I became. Along the way, I freelanced a lot. And I was always on the go. And I wanted things that would adapt and evolve with me. And that was the birth of Kensho.
Hmm. So it came from the need for someone who does think for a living and who gets paid to think, but also likes to work with their hands and moves around a city like New York a lot. That's where that's the origin of Kensho, to try to create clothing. Is that the right word? Clothing, outerwear for somebody outerwear. In that kind of lifestyle, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and I say this now, like right now, the manifestation of it might be outerwear, but the reality is that's not the outcome that I want people to have. The outcome is I want people to reach their full potential. I want them to be present in what it is. And the epiphany that I had is that we as humans, individuals, people, whatever else, you are what you carry. If I were to remove you from a picture and you were to open your bag, I can get a very good sense about what you are about, what you care about, what you do on a day-to-day basis. But if you don't have a good way to carry the things that are important to you and shape your day and your reality, like your value isn't, you don't have as much value as you could. So, and the analogy that I give is if you're a basketball player, you don't just need a basketball. You need shoes, you need clothes, you need things that are going to help you be the best basketball player that you can be. And that's true for your everyday person. And I realize that most brands are set up either for sport or professional, there wasn't something that transitioned between the two. And my goal at the end of the day is to help everyone reach their full potential. So what I make may change, but the goal of helping people reach their potential is what I actually set out to do.
Hmm. And with a focus on what they can carry on their bodies.
Correct.
Right?
For now.
And so, for now, okay. And so could you talk us through an item of clothing or two where the way that someone might carry something around a city like New York has affected some of the design decisions?
Yeah. So, I mean, my hero product is called the Crossover Cowl. It's a reinvention of the scarf. And as I mentioned before, I was building a motorcycle. And if you go to my website or if you watch any of the videos on Instagram, whatever else, you can see my bike, you can kind of see my process, or even go to my personal website. But in building that bike, and if you're going 60, 80, 100 miles an hour, what I realized, the thing that I needed the most and made me feel the most vulnerable was my neck. Because, you know, you're getting hit with wind in front, and when it's cold, you know, it's November. When I got off the bike, my nose would be running because there's a dramatic change in temperature between me being on the bike and me arriving. So my nose would run. So when I go up into the office, I'd always have to go to the bathroom, change, gather myself. And I said, you know what? If I just had something that I didn't have to pull over my head, mess up my hair, and forget that I was wearing when I went to meetings, I would just be that much more prepared to be present. And that's when I designed the Crossover Cowl. And the way I designed the process was I said, I really want something that I don't have to pull over my head. I want something that gives me full protection front and back and looks good with anything that I wear. I could be wearing a suit, or I could be wearing a t-shirt, and I want to be able to wear the same thing. So when I go to that workshop, I mean, like a mechanic shop, I can just take it on, take it off, and I can get right to, you know, being a mechanic if I needed to be. And that's where the Crossover Cowl, the idea of it came from. So I learned how to sew because I taught myself how to sew leather bags for the motorcycle. That's how I learned how to sew. I took origami classes to understand how to create flat folds that worked in parallel with each other. And then just working on the bike in itself, I realized that I wanted no gaps in terms of how it fit with my helmet, how it fit like with the suit. So if you wear a blazer, if you have to dress up to go to work or any casual, most blazers and jackets leave a gap on your chest, and I wanted something that would fill that gap but didn't look frumpy on my chest if I was wearing a scarf. And when I rode my bike, I didn't want it to be flapping in the wind. So that informed the form factor of the design. So all those things culminated in me creating the Crossover Cowl. And when I did some research, I found out that the neck is one of the only places on the body that can literally change your experience. So it can warm you up or it can cool you down in under 5 minutes. So I designed the cowl to be able to be adjustable with one hand. You can put it on in 2 seconds or take it off. So part of the design is it's designed to be put on and put away at the same time. So it's designed to be tucked into the sleeve of a jacket or into an inside pocket. So you don't even have to see it if you don't want to, once you take it on and off. Because that's part of also what I realized is that scarves, they're almost a burden of things you have to carry, and a lot of people hate it. And that's where one of the principles was making convenience classy for people. How do I always make things presentable and work fluidly in how you wear and carry it? So ultimately you can be present in what it is you choose to do in life.
I mean, that's a really detailed way to think about and then to learn about how to make a relatively innocent looking product, a cowl, right? I don't own one of those. I definitely relate to the scarf issue because, you don't want to lose it. It means you're going to waste money on the thing that you lost, or you stick it in your coat and it's all puffy and now you're puffy and it's uncomfortable and now it's making you hot, all that kind of stuff. But it's a really detailed way to think about the problem that you're trying to solve with a relatively innocent looking piece of clothing. Is that the level that you go into, the level of detail that you go into when you're coming up with a new product, that you really think about a specific problem that you can solve and a unique way that you can solve that problem with the product before you even make it?
Correct. So I'll back up a little bit. So I was partly getting disillusioned with working in my jobs. So I wasn't giving 100% of myself to the work. So I felt underutilized. So I wanted to make something where I gave 110% of myself to manifesting something that I could be proud of every day. So partly why I started the company is I wanted to dedicate 125% of my day to being my best, to reaching my full potential in whatever it was, so that when I went to bed at night, I wasn't exhausted. I was energized. I can say I did everything I can do today to the best of my ability, and other people recognize the level of quality, thought, and care that goes into that product, and that's what fulfills me. I also wanted to be in control of my time. So, and by making that decision, I control my time, how I spend my day. So I have to be very considerate on the choices that I make every day to make sure I'm being not only productive and profitable, but that I'm being fulfilled.
Just on that, before you go into how you approach product, what you said is deeply important, that once you have the epiphany that you can make your own reality, and then some people could linger on that for a decade before they really make any difficult decisions. And they are difficult decisions if you're not used to that. You were exposed at a very young age to your own reality and to being rewarded for living your own reality with 50/50, the Bamboo Hat Company. But once you determine that there are realities you can live in, one of them is the one that you make, then all the other things have to happen, which you've talked about, which is you then have to take responsibility for that reality. You have to create it. You have to manifest it every single day. You have to enjoy the independence and the freedom that comes with it. But that's not to say that you don't have any responsibility. You have to take control of your time in the day. And so, I think if people identify with that epiphany, that they could create their own reality, it comes with all kinds of energy, excitement, fear, and it's not easy. But mostly the beautiful realization that every single day is yours to determine what you do with it. And that can come with reward and a lot of risk as well.
Yeah, and you got to be ready for the risk. And so when I started 50/50, I wasn't ready for it. When I worked all my jobs, I wasn't ready for it. So, I would, partly why I would get frustrated in all those jobs is I wasn't taking responsibility. In the jobs that I did really well, I was fully responsible. I owned it. Like, no one told me what to do, but the jobs that I didn't do so well, I allowed other people to inform, dictate what the outcome should be. And I never really wanted to be, I never wanted to feel that way again. So, I can go to every experience, job experience. I can say, like, that product came to market because I was single-minded about making that product a reality because I knew what the end goal was. But the jobs that I didn't do so well, I allowed other people to do that for me. And I didn't want to do that anymore. I had to have an internal conversation with myself. And I said, okay, what is important to me? And I need to be responsible for my actions every day. And a lot of people aren't ready for that. So a lot of people go on a day-to-day saying, what about my security? I don't know if I have enough money. And the way I operate, and it's a mantra that I tell people all the time, and this is true. So I don't know how to swim, but I'm an amazing surfer. And that's kind of the way I live my life. So the things that I can't do, even from when I was a kid, like I said, I didn't have good grades, but I wanted to go to college, figure it out. When there is no safety net behind me is when I'm at my best because I have no other option. And when I feel that there is a safety net and I get comfortable with it, that's when I'm not satisfied because I'm allowing other people to tell me what to do or how to live my life or how to execute against a vision that I may or may not agree with. I may agree with it for a short period of time, but at the end of the day, I'm no longer in control. I have to show up every day. I have to take on projects that I'm given. I have to either work within a budget or whatever. There are constraints you're working within. And constraints are good, but I want to be able to define or break those at my own will. And all the things that I've worked on professionally taught me what things that I could flex or what things that were non-negotiable or what things that made sense. So all those things kind of led me to this point where I felt I was ready to be responsible for myself and also responsible for all my employees, my vendors, the outcomes. So, I had to teach myself lots of things. I had to teach myself how to do photography. I had to teach myself how to edit. I had to teach myself how to sew. I had to teach myself how to work with manufacturers. I had to teach myself about the manufacturing process. There's lots of things I had to teach myself along the way. And that was the exciting part. I was doing things that were unknown to me. And as a result, I was evolving as a person. And the manifestation of that is, Kensho or a product. But ultimate goal, I myself was evolving. And that's the big epiphany that I had. The reason why I exist is to evolve. What I do tomorrow will be different from what I'm doing today. And that's a good thing. But as long as I'm intentional about the process, then I have no regrets.
I love it. Is there anything that you would add about how you approach product, which products to make, how to make them?
Yeah. So the way I approach products is what I learned from doing strategy, how to observe people, what their pain points are, prototyping and testing, creating messaging, testing, A/B testing, those things, putting things in front of people. So when I started, I made a prototype and I took it to a flea market. I forget which one, Artisan Flea, and I set up a booth and I made it look nice. And I had different versions of the product. And the one that I invested in is the one that sold the best. I said, okay, that's good designs. And I would also interview every single person that either bought a product and I'd ask them why they bought it, what mattered to them about it, and why they didn't like the other ones. And then I created personas out of the analogous of all those. So I have three core type of customers now based off of that feedback. And then I designed or edited, iterated based on those types of consumers and how I was seeing. Okay. And then I said, okay, let me go before I even, then I had a prototype. Then I put an ad out online on Facebook to see if people responded to it from a messaging standpoint. I got my first customer. I remember it like it was yesterday. Perfect stranger from Colorado. Someone I never know, whatever else. I only put like $5 towards this thing, but he was so enthusiastic about what I had made. And I said, this is the best because I just sold this person an idea that I had in my head. And he literally bought this idea, not only with his money, but in trusting me as a perfect stranger. And yeah. I love that feeling.
It is beautiful. I hope you don't mind me throwing in something about stuff I've done. Like, I've recently published a book and I see it turning up in countries I've never visited. And sometimes my book's on a beach and I've barely been to a beach in 2 years, or someone highlights text that really matters to them, or recently someone bought a book for their loved one and gave it to them as part of a romantic relationship, and it's deeply stirring. Not all entrepreneurs would relate to that or seek that out. Some people are more mechanical, create a business, have it scale, make money. Others of us that are a bit more, I don't know, involved in the emotion of what we do. It's quite surreal and deeply stirring and motivating. And then you just want more of it, right?
Correct. And really the thing about that too, and this is about creating your own reality, is I made a decision that I only want to work with people who are unafraid of the unknown. Meaning that they want to take a risk, they want to create something new outside of their core skill set. And that's where that's what I like to do. That's where I got excited. When I would go into an agency and I'd work with a creative director or a designer or someone else and say, oh, we're going to make, like, there's this idea, how do we make this thing real? And then working with them to figure out how to manifest that thing. So I do that on a daily basis. And I gravitate towards people who share that sense of awe and curiosity, and that's part why I'm why I was a strategist, because I'm just curious about the world at large. But I'm also curious about working with really interesting people with an appetite to create things that don't exist. So part of what I look for is that in other people. So for the last 3 years, I basically ended any relationship with anyone who wasn't working towards creating things. And I said, for 2019, I only want to be around people who are founders, who are starting things, or who are taking leaps and bounds in unusual ways.
That's hardcore. Why'd you do that?
Like I said, I can't swim, but I'm a great surfer. When you take out the safety net, then you can make a leap. And I needed to make a leap in life. And I can only do that if I dedicate myself 125% to one core single goal. Yeah, and that's what I'm my best.
Yeah, that's a really brave act of brinkmanship to just cut off anybody who doesn't share a similar energy. I'd be curious to see how you feel about that in coming years, because you might see it with slightly different eyes and nuance in the future, because the type of person you're talking about, they're not very common.
I disagree.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Well, I'm talking about the type of person who has the same energy as you and who sees the world in the way that you do.
No, I don't expect that. So that's part of the being a strategist. My job is to identify attributes of people that I can leverage. So because I'm not a classically trained designer in any form or fashion, I can't make anything myself. What strategy has taught me is how to sell an idea and how to appeal to aspects of people to get them excited about an idea that I create. So no one's going to share the same viewpoint as I do at any point in time, but there are aspects that I have to dial up or down based on who I'm speaking to. So when I was creating the bike, it's a moped, it's not a motorcycle, but it's a bike that doesn't exist. I made it in my head. I had to go to a fabricator and get them excited about creating a new technique to fabricate the frame of my bike. Not because, they make motorcycles for a living, but they had never made a bike like mine. And lots of people told me, no, it can't be done. It doesn't exist. But when you find that one person, it's like, you know what? This will be fun. I want to try that. That's when I get excited, because we're working towards the same goal based on our unique skill sets.
Yeah. And look, I mean, America, it has a lot of these people, but I think as a percentage of population, what you're describing isn't that common, and so it's definitely a brave act to cut out anyone who doesn't identify with that. Last question for you. I mean, you've laid out your entire journey for us, and it's amazing to look at it neatly, I guess, on a piece of paper. Not that it's on a piece of paper, but for a strategist who's a full-time employee right now, who might be a bunch of steps back, who just has a hunch that maybe they want to get closer to product, and maybe that getting closer to product is them making their own product, but they're not quite sure. It's just a hunch. That person could procrastinate for another 5 years, another 10 years. What would you say to them to help them work out what it is that they want to make, and then how to go about getting the skills to make it?
So, I mean, in strategy, what I had to do was create my own deliverables that were unique to me. So, you know, when I was at AKQA, I started like a newsletter where I would identify 5 things around the world that no one had heard of. And then I would always, my exercise for myself was to say, so what? Why should anyone care? And how would that benefit our clients? So, you know, I created this newsletter and it became like a really compelling thought piece within the company that they would send to the clients, because it was an original thought that then became actionable. So I can have a discussion that allowed me to have a discussion with the client because I was thinking about their business in a way that they hadn't thought about before, as an example. Or in the case of, you know, if you work in marketing or advertising, besides writing a deck and all that stuff, what I would do is I would take photography and I would learn how to lay out Keynote. So Keynote is my Photoshop. I'm so good at Keynote. Like I can do videos. I can edit in there. Like I can do a lot in Keynote, which basically makes me look like a designer. So I learned how to design in Keynote and make my deliverables look so like professional that people would look for me for that. Or in some cases, I would just create, you know, a slightly different skill set than any other strategist in the organization, meaning I would go out into the world or whatever else, and I would bring things to the office. And I'd say every Friday, I'm going to bring something new and we're going to talk about it. So we had like a show and tell kind of Friday, or I would write a little deck and say, here's interesting things that are going around the world. Here's why they matter again. So those things kind of define it. Instead of allowing, you know, people within the company to tell me what to do, I started to define the way I was thinking about strategy. So I was evolving the way I was thinking about my role. And then I can have a candid conversation with, you know, my boss, like, I want to work on these types of projects. Here's how I'm thinking about them. I want those things. So I was setting myself, and there's a book that I was reading called Scholar Warrior and a couple of other books, but you know, it talks about you have to become known for something, regardless of what it is within an organization. Otherwise, people don't know what to look for. They'll just put you on a project and then you'll get frustrated. So I was looking for ways to do that. But part of doing that is I really just wanted to like own something unique to me that, you know, I could own. And that was my way of doing it.
I love it. So start making stuff, specifically stuff that can be unique to you while you're an employee, and start making that stuff in a way where you can put your name on it. And through that, you learn, you meet people, you see what you're interested in, and people in the organization can look to you for the stuff that you're actually interested in. I love that. George, where's the best place for people to find you on the internet?
You can find me at kensho.com. That's kynsho.com. Or you can find me on Instagram at kensho. Or you can shoot me an email at info@kensho.com. And just to give you a last thought, just where I'm at now, also when I started my company, I made a decision that I was never going to go back to an agency. I freelance every now and then, but I was going to go back as a client, an advisor, or a partner. So I was never going to be an employee ever again. I was going to be on the same level as the people who were telling me what to do. And I think that is something that keeps me motivated on a day-to-day basis, is how do I be on equal par with the people who I look up to and who I advise. And the reason why I say that is because it's only when you can prove your worth do people value you. And that's what I strive to do every day. I think this conversation that we're having today is evidence and proof. I've followed you for a long time, and here we are having a conversation as equals, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, I try to have conversations with people as equals anyway. I mean, it's just me and my silly haircut and accent. But what I find really interesting is, you know, the way that you talk in such detail about your intention and what you've tried to do and decisions you've made, without knowing you well, it's definitely the sign of a very self-aware and conscientious, but also sort of conscious person. So I'm really curious to see what you end up doing and how far you take this. And I'm sure you're going to create a whole bunch of other companies in the future. But it's the detail and the thoughtfulness and the self-analysis that we can lay out in a very neat way while it might be messy in the moment. It's deeply impressive, George. I appreciate you sharing your story with me today on Sweathead.
Thanks for having me.
Peace.
Take care.